we start every one of these with a little song. And
God. We're going to perform in front of
Rick's
I'm totally daunted, and he's probably going to roll his eyes when he's done with this. But, all right, this.
Well, maybe he can learn it. Maybe we could teach it to him, and he can sing it at the end.
This might become a big hit. We have no idea.
All right.
When the people that you know don't like you, and your treasured friendships end, tune into this podcast where your artificial friends.
That's lovely.
Are you intimidated?
I'm incredibly intimidated. Don't play any of my music after that.
Newfound respect for us here.
Ladies and gentlemen, Rick Springfield joins us. Thanks for coming by.
Yeah, glad to.
So I'm just curious, what's nicer, our green room or Corolla's green room?
Well, his green room's full of cars, so it's kind of... yours is full of kids. They're both pretty cool in their own way. I like kids and cars. Adults, not so much.
Two different flavors. I want to start by playing this. Get a load of this song. It is called Little Demon. It's off The Snake King, his new bluesy album. Drinking a little bit of this. So now the acoustic fills that I'm hearing in this, is that you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me, and I'm playing the acoustic riff and then the electric riff on top of it, and then I do the first solo and play slide also on it.
So when people come to see you, who don't know what to expect, what are the looks on their faces when they're like, "That's Rick Springfield playing the blues for me"?
We haven't taken this stuff out on the road yet, but our live show is very full on. It's pedal to the metal, and you know, guys that come with their girlfriends and that they always go away going, "Wow, it's a real rock show. I didn't know you could play guitar," and that kind of thing. So, you know, the one dimensional soap opera pop geek, which I cherish, that image, but we do like, you know, I do like to blow it up every now and then.
Is this something you were always doing on your own, just kind of
playing
this way, playing blues?
Yeah,
my
first bands were, the first band I was in Australia that was had any success, it was a big riff band. I mean, I used to write all these riffs, and we have a version that I arranged of Eleanor Rigby that's like a big heavy riff thing that people hear it now and go, "Wow, it sounds like Black Sabbath." But I'm a guitar player, and so I was focused on the guitar when I wrote songs.
Everything comes from, you know, I mean, there are only 12 tones repeated.
I know, isn't that amazing?
Only
26 letters and 12 notes, and look at all the amazing shit people have done with it.
It's true, but that's where it all starts, right? At least from a rock standpoint, it all kind of comes from, well, at least in the Western Hemisphere, from the Delta blues.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, certainly the rock music came completely out of there. Jazz had something to do with it, but you listen to blues music through the years, and you can hear the transformation of it happening. You know, from like Lightning Hopkins up to Albert King, you can hear the change happening where rock got its, you know, hair on its balls.
Yeah, I should cover this real quick too. I'd like to get this stuff out. First, the album just dropped on Friday, and you can buy it wherever albums are sold. I was talking to Greg Lake one time, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, mm-hmm. and he gave me a really... I was surprised by the answer. I said, "What do you guys call the music that you make? Do you call it prog rock? You know, what was the
music?
How did you describe it?" He said, "Well, it was just rock and roll.
Yeah,
it's just that instead of what all the other bands were doing, using American blues, you know, artists as the basis for mm-hmm. what they were doing and selling it back to the world, we used European influences. You're Australian, and you were growing up, and you were listening to music there. How did you?
My influences were definitely English. We got the Beatles in 1964, and I remember seeing them. I was in the audience. 14 years old and amazed that the Beatles would come all this friggin' way to Australia, right? So we were very influenced by all the English bands, but the, you know, like the Yardbirds and the Stones, who were influenced by all the black American blues. So that we, that's how we were introduced to the American music, was through those kind of English artists that translated it into their, you know, their own way. And then we went back looking for those original records, and that's how we discovered American blues. And that's, and all my first bands were blues bands, trying to get as obscure as we could. We'd find a Lightning Hopkins album and take probably the least coverable track and do it, you know, and go, yeah, just take that
challenge.
You don't even know what that song is.
We're not playing any, the hits.
Any enduring memories of seeing the Beatles live?
Oh my God, I it was, honestly, it was like aliens had landed. You know, the bands that were opening for them were all Australian bands, and they were all, at that point, were still in the Elvis mode with the pompadour hair and black leather and the kind of moves. And and then the Beatles walked on stage, and it was like, I mean, they looked so friggin' modern. It was awesome. They had beautiful suits and Cuban heel shoes and long hair and these guitars, big, bright guitars. It was incredible. And then they opened their mouths, and it was truly like, you know, the Eagles landed. It was incredible.
There was a, I'll drop a name of who I've interviewed, but Andy and I have both interviewed Stephen Van Zandt at various times, but he talks about that.
You know who told me you should never drop names? Elvis. Okay. Just okay.
Yeah, he mentioned that to me a few times.
Anyway, I've interviewed a very high-profile rhythm guitarist who plays for a very popular enduring solo artist. He was talking about the night that the Beatles played on Ed Sullivan for the first time, mm-hmm. and that the next day, every other kid in America was finding a guitar and starting a band in the garage.
Absolutely.
Was there a kind of a sea change moment in Australia that was anything similar to that?
Yeah, because we didn't get that show, but we saw the Beatles live, which was pretty freaking awesome.
So
right?
It was the live show.
I actually fell in love with the guitar before then. I was living in England when I was a kid, and they had these school Christmas show, you know, where you put your kid gets up and plays some horrible song, and everyone goes, "Oh, that was amazing!" And so
that still happens.
Yes, it does. I've been to them, and it's painful. And you know, I was backstage. I was like 11 years old, and this guy, his big thing was going to get up and play guitar, and he had this beautiful golden Hofner that I'd never seen a guitar live before. I'd seen photos of it, but seeing it in its presence, it was just before girls were on the map for me, you know, so it was like I was open, and I fell in love with the guitar, and that was the watershed moment for me where I said, I gotta get to know this thing a little better.
Just,
you know?
The instrument.
Yeah, just the instrument. I fell in love with the guitar first, and then I got a guitar at 13, and there was a band in England called The Shadows that were an instrumental band, and I idolized them, and then the Beatles happened, and we go, wow, you can actually write your own songs. How hard can it be? Listen to those songs.
What was your first
guitar? A couple of Liverpool kids, right?
What was your first guitar?
It was a Framus. That's a Framus guitar, because we, in Australia, when I moved back to Australia, Fenders and Gibsons were completely out of our price range. I mean, first of all, they were expensive, but then they were imported.
Right.
So it was like, you couldn't even, you know, a kid couldn't touch it. So we had Framuses and Hofners and Kays, which was an American guitar.
But, yeah.
So that was our, we had the European guitars.
And did you teach yourself from listening to mm-hmm. the radio and records?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, most of the guys I grew up with and the guys I play with now are all self-taught.
That's crazy. Now, you're born.
We all are.
Rick Springthorpe.
Thorpe, yeah. And there's a convict.
Isn't that maybe a cooler name? Spring, that just sounds athletic and strong.
Well, it didn't to me when I was a kid.
Really?
And it got changed on me, actually. I was Rick Springthorpe Ricky Springthorpe, actually. And I joined this band out of high school. I was 15, and the guy said, what's your name again? Rick something. I said, it's Rick Springthorpe. And he said, no one will ever understand that. You're Springfield. So from then on, I was Rick Springfield.
I went to school in Greenwood, Indiana. Mm-hmm. Betty Mellencamp was my English teacher. Charles Mellencamp was the counselor. Bill Mellencamp was the
you mean Cougar
teacher. They were all Mellencamp.
Betty Cougar.
You couldn't swing a dead cat in Central Indiana
without a Mellencamp.
Mellencamp. And he had that same thing where it was actually David Bowie's manager, Tony DeFries, who says, you know, I can't sell records by a John Mellencamp. I can sell Johnny Cougar. And so he put out this album. And
then changed
he
back.
Yeah. Hated it for so yeah. long because he was put out there. I mean, he's wearing lipstick and stuff right. on his first album cover. Did you feel at all, like once the machine got behind you, that you were treated that way?
No, not at all, actually, because I was always, I mean, I find that hard to believe with Cougar, cause, I mean, Mellencamp, because he's, you know, is all about his music, but I was never guided, like, you know, you need to do this. I've heard a lot of artists say, you know, yeah, they wanted me to wear makeup, they wanted me to do my hair a certain way, wear certain clothes, but I just did what I wanted, and that was the way I did it, you know? I mean, we never had, like, record company people coming into sessions. I didn't like that, you know? We just presented the record, and sometimes it hit, and sometimes it flopped. But, no, I never really had... And the Springfield thing, I just... I was actually happy to have a name that people could friggin' understand. Because, honestly, you'd say Springthorpe, and they go, Springfield, and they go, no, Springthorpe. Springthorpe? No, Springthorpe. Yeah. Springfort? No, yeah. Springthorpe. Thorpe.
It would be strange if all of a sudden, it's one thing going from Cougar back to your original name, because Cougar right. was, that's like one of those Johnny Bravo kind of, like, made-up right, right. names. Right, yeah. But the subtle change of, no, you coming out and going, no, I would prefer to be Springthorpe, please. That's
well, it's almost the same. No, it's not the same. There's a Thorpe. And there's a
You would have been considered the most pretentious prick
yeah,
of all time.
Pretty much. Yeah. Pretty much. And it's so Richard, it. Not Rick.
Richard Springthorpe, please.
Middle name Lewis.
Oh, God. So 1981. Jesse's Girl. I dug up a couple of things.
I'm sorry, what's that?
That surprised me. That song.
That's a song I wrote a little while ago.
Oh.
Yeah.
Jesse's Girl took 19 weeks mm-hmm. from the time it entered the top 40 to getting to number one.
Thing had legs.
So I'm assuming you're touring that summer and you're out promoting the thing. Did you imagine it was going to get to number one? Did you? Because that's the longest run to number one ever at that point.
Yeah, we hope so, but it seemed to have pretty good power behind it going up. It didn't kind of go up a bit and then drop down and go up and drop down. It just kind of kept taking a step up. Yeah. And so it was great when it hit number one, but I wasn't that really kind of worried about it. I mean, I was just happy to. The people were buying the record.
Yeah. Then you follow up with a top 10 single, and I've done everything for you. Larry, I've been a DJ for 29 years, and I didn't know until this week that song was written by Sammy Hagar.
Yeah.
Yeah. He put it on his album first?
Did he?
Yeah, I think he did a live version. Yeah. That's where we got it from. And Keith Olsen was working with him, and Keith's a great cross-pollinator. And actually, recently we toured with Pat Benatar. Recently, and I've known them since the 80s, and Neil, I wrote in my autobiography that the Keith brought me I've Done Everything For You, and Neil said when we're out in Syria, no, I read your book and I found that song.
Oh.
I went, oh, okay. But yeah, and Sammy was great. He was great because he helped, you know, like one of the shows, he helped us get lights and sound together and everything. He's a real supporter. He'd make fun of it on stage, you know, say, yeah, this song was a hit by this guy because I didn't know why till I met him, and I, you know, so, oh, he's cute, okay, I get it, you know, and he'd always make fun of that kind of thing, so, but he's great. I mean, he gave me a bottle of his private stock tequila a couple of years ago with, to Rick, You've Done Everything For Me, Love Sammy, on the label.
See, that's nice.
That's big. I'm out of my depth in this conversation. Obviously, being a sports guy, it's fascinating.
So I don't know nothing about sports.
It's fascinating.
Neither does Sam, weirdly.
Exactly. But I can fake that. I just wonder how people generally react when you take their song and you make it a hit. And it's, you know, is that the common response, or is that big of Sammy Hagar?
To what? To do?
To
kind of be supportive of?
Be so magnanimous to you.
Yeah, it is. It was unusual. And I think Sammy was a relatively kind of unknown. He was known in the South back then, I think. But he was, you know, still basically a struggling musician too. But he was bigger than I was. In fact, which is why they released that as the first single originally. And the radio didn't pick it up. And then they picked up Jesse's Girl. And then they released I've Done Everything For You second. And then on the... You know, and it became a hit then. But I have ADD. So I completely forgot what I was talking about.
I bet that Sammy Hagar is crying on a big bag of money.
Yeah, I saw him. Last time I saw him was the Chelsea Handler goodbye thing, and she invited everybody to it, right? And he comes up to me and with his kids and said, "Hi, this is Rick Springfield. Thank him for your college years."
Nice.
So he's got a great sense of humor, and he's a great guy, and I think an amazing singer too.
Yeah, he's a really nice guy. Well, that's, I would imagine, like Bruce Springsteen,
Bruce Springfield. Well, he was on General Hospital.
Manfred Mann took Blinded by the Light.
Oh yeah,
right. Oh,
and
right.
Huge hit out of it.
It's Bruce Springsteen to this day is only number one.
Yeah, right.
And somebody else is the one who got it to number
one. Who was I Will Always Love You? Is that Dolly Parton?
Dolly Parton wrote it, and Whitney Houston had the giant.
That's a Whitney Houston song that if you just have to know that's Dolly Parton's.
Yeah. I'm sure.
There's a lot of those, actually. There's more of those.
Let's spend the rest of the podcast figuring those out.
All right.
Great. The greatest covers of all time with Rick.
You know, I got to say, I was on a flight from New York coming back to L.A., and you were on it, too. I had been upgraded. I think you were a few. It was a pretty empty flight.
I don't usually allow people up in the
section. No, but one thing that struck me.
Please do not look directly at Mr. Springthorpe.
No, one thing, my takeaway.
Stewardess, he's looking me in the eye. I'm not going to stand for it.
No, my takeaway was, I didn't say anything. I was a bit away, but I thought, that guy seems like this flight attendant had spilled a bunch of coat hangers on the ground or something. You were helping to pick him up, and I thought, he is a regular guy. That was my takeaway. I thought, that's a cool guy. I mean, he's not taken with himself.
That's why I'm still Springfield. And didn't go, Well, my dad was, I never believed that anyone has any reason to be anything than they are, just another human being, and respect everybody else. And my dad taught me that. Well, I learned it from my dad, just watching him. He was an officer in the Army, Australian Army. And he's the only officer that when he retired, enlisted men came to his send-off, because usually enlisted men hated the officers because they treated them like shit. But he had all these enlisted guys come, and he's just a great human being. And everybody's as powerful as everybody else, you know. Just because someone got a little more notoriety or something like that. I get nervous occasionally meeting famous or wealthy people. There's a bit of you always in you goes, wow, they're got more money than I do. Right.
I mean, have you ever had that kind of starstruck fan moment? God,
With Paul McCartney.
Oh, well.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I mean, who doesn't?
Yawn.
Who sees McCartney and goes, that guy.
Ah, whatever, man, dude. You're the wings guy, right?
Yeah.
I was, he was more interested in my wife.
Interesting.
Which really pissed me off, because she just had our second child, and we were backstage to meet him, and I'm gearing up, oh my god, I'm going to meet Paul McCartney, I'm finally going to meet Paul McCartney, oh my god, here he comes, and he walks up to me and looks at me, shakes my hand, and looks at my wife and goes, oh, hello, love, and walks over to my wife and starts chatting her up. And I'm thinking, I'm the fucking fan.
What about Meryl Streep? Was there any intimidation?
Oh.
You were in Ricky and the Flash.
Yeah.
Intimidation of, hi, I'm a rock star, and I'm going to do a movie with the greatest living actor.
The greatest, yeah. I actually, for the audition, they just wanted me to get up and play guitar with her in a band sitting, just to see, first of all, what our chemistry was. And that was kind of what sold it initially, because we had really great chemistry just playing off each other in this band thing. And I walked into the room cold, and there's Meryl Streep talking to Jonathan Demme, who directed Silence of the Lambs and Married in the Mob. And I say, hey, how you doing? And I get up on the mic and say, I'm about to jam with Meryl Streep. And she got up on the mic and said, I'm about to jam with Rick Springfield. So it was great, kind of a great tension relief, because, you know, she knows people have to get past the, oh my God, it's Meryl Streep moment, just like McCartney has to know that everybody has to get past the, oh my God, it's a Beatle, you know.
She seems really down there.
She's awesome. She's great. She was great to work with, and she's real professional, and is a great, you know, she just wanted to be authentic in the part, which is her goal, really. She didn't want to be a virtuoso guitar player. She wanted to know that she looked authentic playing the guitar. Oh, and she'd ask us funny questions, which was great, and very stress relieving for me, because I'm kind of going, oh my God, I'm going to like pull off this part in front of Meryl Streep. But she was concerned about pulling off the part of a musician in front of us, which were all like professional musicians in the band. And she actually said, where do I actually get on the microphone when I'm singing? Am I like on top of it, or am I? So she had no concept of that.
It's disarming.
Yeah. So yeah, it was great. And in between takes, like when we're doing the music stuff, she'd just sit on the floor with a guitar, and we'd launch into like "You Really Got Me" or some of the old songs, and we'd stop and she'd go, "Play some more." she said it was the most fun she'd ever had in a set.
That is one of the most impressive things about you to me, is that there. I think we can all see that there are a lot of actors who have like tried to be rock stars. There are a lot of musicians who have dabbled in acting to varying degrees of success, but you're one of the very few who you can say, if you just looked at your IMDb acting credits, that'd be a working actor who did pretty well for himself. Yeah. And then you've got this music career at the same time, and both of them would be considered very successful careers. Did they clash with each other? Did one fill the gap if the other one started to wane?
I think probably the second one. I certainly got into acting because I was between record deals and.
So you thought of yourself as a musician first and foremost.
Yeah. And I'd always thought of acting because my brother was an actor in Australia. When between record deals, I'm kind of struggling to pay the light bill, you know, and I naively said, you know what, I think I'll become an actor to make money while I'm waiting for a record deal to come along, while everybody else in the acting class I was attending was waiting tables until they got an acting gig. So
your backup plan was acting.
Yes.
You were not a business major.
No. I'd actually foregone, you know, mom said, you got to be a plumber, become an electrician, something to fall back on, because you can't make a living playing the guitar. I obviously did not listen to that, no.
Yeah. Good what call. Are the peculiarities of being a soap opera actor? What's that like? What are
tough,
the,
toughest acting gig there is?
Why?
Because it's all about line memorization. They give you 30 pages and they say, you know, 30 pages one day, then 30 pages the next day, and there's very little change from one to the other because it's all conversation. There's no action on the soap. And so you got to memorize this stuff. And to me, it became about line memorization. It didn't become about acting. And I was just struggling with all the words all the time, and it's constant, and the pressure's insane, because if you screw up, they go, oh my God, let's reset.
Because there's not a lot of second takes in that situation.
If a camera blows up or something, right. they may go for a second take, or if someone drops dead, if they can't write it into the scene right away, though.
do you remember a time when you
make it sound like that's happened? It?
Yeah. Oh my God, Dr. So-and-so just dropped dead.
Now, do you remember a time when you had to wing it? And you might have forgotten something.
When I was on the soaps, they still had idiot boards, you know, where they'd have a scrolling thing right next to the camera, which saved my ass so many times.
Oh, man.
And I got so good at it that the red light would come on the camera, meaning you're on that your camera is on you. As soon as it would go off, instead of looking at the actor and listening to them, I'd look at my words over here and get my words, and then just in time for the red light to go on, I'd look back at the actor. And so it was really, it was very tough. It was not really anything about acting. It was about getting the lines out. So it's very hard. I know there are people who do it really well, but I wasn't one of them.
When Matt LeBlanc is Joey Tribbiani, you're Dr. Noah Drake. When he's Drake Ramore on Friends, is that a nod?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Have you ever talked to him about
it? Yeah, I have. I have. He was actually a real nice guy, and is actually somewhat of a fan of the music and everything. So yeah, it was definitely a unknown
tip
nod.
Of the hat. And then Californication. I saw a bit of the first season. My wife Lara, watched the entire thing. And when I said you were coming over to do the podcast, she goes, "Oh, Californication, he was great." I said, "What was the character that he played?" It was kind of a douchier version of
Yeah, he was a dick. He was a real dick.
was that a lot of fun?
Yeah, it was incredible. It was really great writing, hilarious writing, and I got to, you know, play against type, which I like. And the fact that he was called Rick Springfield was just for them to kind of plug it into some contemporary kind of history of a musical thing, you know, so that they could kind of play with that if they wanted to, which they didn't really much. I mean, just a couple of Jessie's Girl references here and there, but it was basically just, you know, a freaked out, womanizing, egotistical, coke inhaling fuckhead. But it was great. I mean, he didn't think he was, of course, and I didn't play it like that, but that's how they wrote it, so, you know.
And I will say, and I, because I have no problem, you know, nobody's going to come down on me on this, I don't think, you were the only memorable thing about True Detective season two.
Oh, God.
But literally, in my mind, the only thing I can remember, except Vince Vaughn just trying to get through the dialogue, but...
It was tough. The dialogue was difficult.
That,
dialogue.
That writing was bizarre.
So bizarre, and
but,
it was like. It was
but
like,
I don't know what the hell was going on with you. You were just. I could not take my eyes away. That character
was pretty hypnotic.
That was a freak. Oh man, you were good in that.
Great, I appreciate that. Yeah, yeah, it was. It was. It was just. You know, with that kind of dialogue, you got to get something going on inside. And so I had a whole story that, you know, probably had nothing to do with what was going on, but it gave me some attitude and a focus of who this guy was and what he would put out as he's talking to people.
Yeah,
you know, he thought everybody was basically below him, but you know, it was a lot of fun because but the dialogue was so intense, the writer was on the set, and you couldn't deviate.
Oh wow!
You couldn't deviate. It had to be exactly as written, and. And so it was a lot of pressure, but I worked really hard in the dialogue because I got to get the dialogue down. So, because the first thing that goes once you get involved in a scene is the dialogue. First thing goes out of your head. Right. So you got to get it so that you can be connected and still spit out the actual words.
Yeah. Why did everything have to be exactly? Because sometimes are there, and I'm not impugning the writer of this, but are there certain directors you work with or writers who feel like I've written poetry,
yeah,
I've written a tome, and you will read it?
Very much so. And I get that. I mean, it was, the dialogue was very important to him, and it really did, for me, it really did set up how wacky this dude was,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, he would speak. I said, nobody speaks like this. Well, of course they don't, because he's a whack job, and I don't know anybody like this. So I had to figure out who that guy was. But the dialogue was a big driver, and you know, a lot of it is honestly, and I get it. It's like me writing a song and someone changing the lyrics halfway through because, you know, they can't remember mine. I mean, it's like, I get that. I mean, there's a lot of dialogue that is not worthy of saying word for word, but this stuff definitely was. I think he's a great writer. Crazy writer. I mean, really just out there. And I think that's what a lot of the TV is now. It's just how far can we go?
Yeah,
that's true. but we don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I'm curious your thoughts on it. I'm a father now. I've got a 7 and a 3-year-old. And I want them to have happy lives. And my wife and I make... You know, all of our choices are based on how happy can we make, how much of a great childhood can we give them, and I don't mean stuff, I mean just quality of
life.
Yeah,
I get that.
And I read that you suffered from depression when you were a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that someone from the outside might look at it and say, really? You're a good-looking guy, you know how to play music, you're all of these things going for you. You suffer. What, you know? Why would you be afflicted by this? Can you just speak a little bit to that and the misconceptions that people have about it?
Depression is internal, and stuff outside is like a great party. You know, you can forget your troubles for the evening, but when you go home. And, you know, you're looking in the mirror and brushing your teeth, whatever. It's still you staring back at you. And I thought fame would heal me. And it did for a couple of years. You know, I was kind of on the roller coaster and, all right, this is great. Yeah. And then one point it all came home and I realized that nothing had really changed within me, that I was still the same kind of, you know, at my worst, I think I'm a worthless dick. And that's what was staring back at me. And I realized I had to go inside and that nothing I could do outside would change how I felt. And people who don't have depression, you can't really explain it to them. And people who do, you don't really need to, because they get it. I mean, Robin Williams, is what an amazing life he had, you know? I mean, all the people you think of that had incredible lives, it doesn't matter at all to them. It doesn't change how they feel just because of what happens to them externally. It's always, it's internal thing. You got to go in and you got to address it. And I went to therapy for 5 years, and you know, it doesn't heal me. I mean, depression's a lifelong kind of sentence if you want it, but I also know there's a positive side to it from every perspective, and I had to find mine, and mine is that it's a creative part of me, and it's the part that pushes me to do new stuff, because you know, basically I'm not enough, so I got to keep doing new stuff. And and as best I can, not just doing whatever, let me do that, but you know, really pushing my own envelope. And and the depression thing, I started talking about it just because it was part of me, but people have picked up on it, and if they do get something out of it, you know, if you can have some kid, 14, 15 year old kid that's getting bullied, you know, go another month or two and not do something dumb, then it's, you know, it's worth it. I mean, it's really, because everything changes, and I've seen my, you know, my depression goes up and down, up and down, up and down, and I know that it changes now.
Yeah. How cathartic was it to write the book, and what types of reactions did you get?
It was real cathartic, actually. It was a lot of fun to write it. I really got into the writing of it and the creating of it. But when it was done, I called the publisher and said, you can't release this.
No.
And I realized people were going to actually read it. And I thought I came off as a pretty shallow, idiot dude in there. But, you know, it is what it is. And I, you know, there was the obligatory kind of sexual stuff in there about, you know, all the on the road and all that kind of thing. And I've been a pretty much of an idiot that way. And I thought that's what they're going to ask in interviews. But it wasn't. Everybody wanted to know about the depression because it was, that hadn't been brought up before. And so I'm glad I did, because, you know, I don't want to be the depression poster boy, but right. If it helps anybody, then it's a good thing, for sure.
Andy, get to the sex stuff. That's next, right?
Yeah.
I've got 6 pages on that. A friend of my best friend is a acting coach, and he had came up with the Marlon Brando syndrome. People that do things creative. Many of us do it because we, you know, have a hole. Mm-hmm. There's a hole to be filled, and you know, Marlon Brando had this infillible hole. You know, want to be the greatest actor in the world? Done. Still have a hole.
Yep.
Want any woman in Hollywood? Got it. Still have this hole.
Mm-hmm.
Want my own island? Got it. Still have a hole. Want to eat buckets and buckets of ice cream? I can do it, but I still have that hole. You can't ever fill a hole like that. You've got to fall in love with the hole.
I think you got to at least understand the hole is within you, and it's not a hole sitting on the sidewalk that you can fill with stuff. You know, a beautiful house, a big car, the prettiest wife, you know, the most money. It's in absolutely inside you, and that's why, you know, all the stuff you listed didn't fix him, because it doesn't and it can't, and it's inside you. And there is a degree, a point you have to accept it. And know that, I mean, it was horrific to me when I realized that a big house and fame and whatever I had didn't really change how I felt about myself. And that was, it was frightening, because I thought, fuck, what do I do now? You know, so I started going to therapy, because that was, I realized that it's inside. And it did help. It did identify my demons, but it didn't erase them. But I do recognize, and it's familiar to me now, and they're a part of it that I do love. I mean, I do love that I can write, I can get dark enough to write songs that I want to write, and that say something about that darkness, or even if it's a, you know, like the only party song I think I ever wrote was "Love Is a Right Tonight" off my first album. I mean, Jesse's Girl is stuff I didn't, as a girl I didn't get. Don't Talk to Strangers is sexual paranoia. I mean, it's all dark stuff.
Well, let's face it. The Snake King, in this album, you're back to the blues.
half of blues songs are about getting a gun and going finding where your woman is that
absolutely.
Morning.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it seemed the appropriate. It's a blues infused album. I wouldn't necessarily call it a blues album, but it seemed the appropriate tack for this dialogue that I had that became this record, The Snake King. It's dark stuff, you know. It's a tongue in cheek on some of it, but it's definitely from a dark, questioning place.
Most of the great songs, period, are heartbreak, loss.
Yeah,
things the 10% of the songs are "I'm walking on sunshine" and Pharrell's happy, and that's it. I think it's those two.
That's it.
I think that's all.
I think you're exactly right, because you don't. When you're feeling great, you don't go, damn it, why am I feeling so good? Right?
I think I'll write a song about it.
Yeah. It's when you feel like crap and you go, God, what is wrong with me? You know? Why am I feeling this? And that's when you go inside and look at stuff, and that's where songs and creative stuff comes from, is over analyzing, over looking at it, you know?
We've talked to so many people who perform, whether it's musicians or stand-up comedians, and they all tend to kind of say the same thing. Are you at the most at home, the most comfortable, the most in control when you're on stage playing?
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm the happiest too. And I think in control is actually a really great phrase that I hadn't encountered before, but I am. When you said that, I said, yeah, I do feel in control. I feel like it's my party. And generally, I don't, you know.
Well, that's because I think, like with stand-up, it happens a lot, because when you're good, you're getting the response that you're there to get. And for you, you know, you're playing, you're satisfying people, you're seeing them dancing, they're responding. You are in control, and you're a showman. You know how to, in those that time that that's your set, you know how to make that click and make that work for people.
Right. Well, there were a lot of times where I would play and there'd be three people in the audience, but I'd still have bravado, you know, I'd still get up there.
And you probably won them over.
Yeah. Well, I remember we were playing somewhere in Florida in like the middle 70s, and I'd had some record out that no one bought, and we're playing the big rock show in front of like three people, and the song finishes and like crickets.
It's like puppet show and Spinal Tap.
Totally. And there were three people sitting like in a corner, and I go, hey, you guys, you didn't like that one?
I think it was Todd Rundgren who said, man, it doesn't matter what kind of music you play. You could play, you know, oompa music. If you go to Pittsburgh, 10 people will come out and see you.
We'll love you.
And then next year, you go to Pittsburgh again, you get 20, and then you get 40. And, you know, whatever it is, if you stick with it and you tour with it, that's kind of what the music industry has become, isn't it? You've got to take the show to people because...
Yeah. Yeah, it's really the record really kind of supports the touring now rather than the other way around. Everybody I know tours, and I mean, even putting new records out is kind of, really? Why are you doing that?
Well, I'm going to jump in here because I'll jump off that question, because my kid question is, I've got a grown-up kid, 26 years old. We invested in six figures worth of theater school at BU for him to be a musician.
What a waste of money.
Thanks, Alex. But no, look, the skills he learned at BU, I'm sure he's using for his... Help me out here, Andy. but if you were starting, like, he's working in New York, he's playing clubs, he's producing his own stuff, he's, you know, working on his laptop. It's, you know, things are very different about the music industry, but there are also things,
new opportunities
that must be kind of the same in terms of the idea of how you get to where you need to be. If you were doing it right now from the very beginning, would you basically approach it the same way, just playing live as much as you can?
There's really only one thing you need to be a successful musician, and that's perseverance. And that's never giving up, never, you know, never saying I'm done, you know. And it's a very tough thing in any career, and it's really been my only real strong point. Because I look back at old stuff and I go, fuck, no wonder I never made it. And, you know, it was horrible. I looked like a friggin' freak, you know. And
you had to be bad for a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you gotta stay on it and not drift off to some other thing and distraction and it's a tough business. Any business is tough if you want to be successful in it, and just stay on it. Really, I mean, I'd just do what I'm doing, which is now I I'd go online. I'd put my songs online. I'd tour as much as I can. And, you know, in the end, it's just kind of hoping something clicks, you know, which has always been that. There's no real Svengali's behind people going, I'm going to take you and make you a star. Yeah. I mean, Epstein didn't do that with the Beatles. The Beatles were the friggin' Beatles. He actually, his great thing was to pull them out of obscurity and have a voice, so you walk into an office and go, oh, this guy's wearing a suit, we better listen to him, you know, and get them deals. Yeah. And but it's your passion and your persistence and just your belief.
I know you've got to go. He's got a sold out show tonight that he's got to go and do a sound check for. Before we wrap it up, though, you've been number one rock star. You've had number one hits. You've been on television, and you've been successful in movies. Now you're making music that you want to still. Is there anything else that's on the burner that you feel like I always wanted to do that I haven't yet?
Well, the blues record, Blues Tinge record, is definitely something I've always wanted to do and what I've wanted to say for a few years, because of this friggin' world we're screwing. But also, I'm writing again, writing prose again, and I want to pursue that really fully. Till I had the Perrier's making me burp. had my own autobiography, which I wrote myself, which is a novel called Magnificent Vibration that was also on both on the New York Times bestsellers, and I want to pursue that because I love that. And you know, it's tough now. It's like music. It's like nobody's reading books anymore. It's very bizarre, and I've never stopped reading. I read every single night, and it's like music. You're listening to records all the time. You listen to music, you analyze it, you play it. That's how you get good at what you want to do, by looking at others. You have to look at others, otherwise there's no place to start.
Yeah.
I just realized Rick Springfield is good at everything, and I kind of hate him now.
I kind of hate him now.
Yeah, he's the guy who was at Live Aid, and I'm going to play this cockamamie song in front of
Woo-hoo!
Him.
Woohoo!
Thanks, Rick. Great to get to know you a little bit.
Yeah,
and
good to talk
come
to
back
you guys.
Anytime. Anytime you have something going on, let us know about it. We'll make sure everybody that hears us know about it.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
And feel free to join in.
Yeah.
When the people that you know don't like
and
you.
And your treasured friendships end.
And your treasured friendships end. Tune into this podcast.
We're your artificial friends.
We're your artificial friends.
That was lovely.
Yeah. That was lovely.
Richard Lewis Springthorpe, everyone. Golf clap, please.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute exquisite pleasure, believe me.